Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey everyone, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets in the car, while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
Hey, I'm Christian Sager, guest hosting.
Yes, Christian's filling in for Julie as she's on a vacation this week. And we took this opportunity to dive into a couple of darker topics. We talked about grimoires. And in this episode, we're talking about a little thing called Satanic Panic. And I feel like depending on where our listeners are in terms of age and geographical location, they're going to have varying levels of intersection with this topic. Based on our previous conversations, I believe we both have varying degrees of contact with the satanic panic of the 1980s, especially a time in which there was a lot of moral panic and outrage over the perceived threat of secret satanic cults, which sounds crazy. It may sound crazy to you, but this was a very real atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean, the peak of satanic panic was between 1985 and around 1992, although I think you can probably trace it even a little further back into the late 70s, probably.
Yeah.
And that, for me, I'm 37, I'm about to be 38, so I grew up. That was the period of time when I was growing up, you know.
Okay, well, we're the same age, so.
Okay, yeah, so... So yeah, like I was in elementary school while all this was going on, and it was something that my parents weren't necessarily as afraid of it, but I had friends whose parents were afraid of it. And then we talked about this off air, but I had an experience where for a year I had to go to a private religious school, and there was a lot of satanic panic within this school, and in particular about demon possession and being the need to be exorcised, or even we had a classmate who was ostracized by our teacher because he was purported to be possessed by the devil.
Oh, wow. I mean, I definitely grew up as well in a family environment where there wasn't a lot of emphasis on satanic panic. It wasn't really a thing in my family, but
yeah.
We'd go to church and you would hear
about the threat or read about the threat in various youth publications that were aimed at us about the dangers of, say, horror literature, about, of course, heavy metal music. And then there were I remember also having friends who were really heavily involved in our youth group and being at a youth coffee house and being asked to come into a back room to set in on an exorcism.
Yeah.
You know, it was this whole atmosphere, you know, that was especially attractive to teens, in which these demonic forces were real. There's this war between the forces of good and the forces of evil, and your soul, your mind is kind of the battleground.
Yeah, and it's satanic panic, or also, you know, the claimed practices are generally termed under the phrase satanic ritual abuse.
Yes,
or SRA for short. We might say that throughout the podcast. But there was this sort of chaos about the general chaos about growing up as a human being in the world, especially mm-hmm. as an adolescent, when you're trying to figure things out, you're trying to make sense of the world. And then along comes this narrative that's basically like, you are at the center of this, and either, these underground mysterious heavy metal cults can transform your soul into, mm-hmm. into darkness, or you can be guarded and, you know, come out on the side of righteousness. And it, you know, it sounds silly. It sounds very, black and white. But yeah, having lived through it, like it's, and especially like going back and then doing the research on this and being like, oh yeah, I remember when that happened. But my little 10-year-old brain, you know, in 1987 couldn't exactly make sense of it, you know? It's just some fascinating stuff, but, largely, Satanic Panic was a combination of there was this idea of repressed memories being brought back, and a lot of these repressed memories were supposedly of interactions or torture within satanic underground organizations.
Yeah, they're secret organizations that are worshiping the devil, and as part of their rites, they are abusing, often sexually, very young children.
Mm-hmm. And that is sort of where the moral panic comes in, that gets everyone involved,
yeah.
at least in the United States.
Threat to the children.
Yeah. This is kind of ironic because I wrote a comic book called this, but think of the children is what it always comes back to with these moral panics, mm-hmm. is that something is going wrong with the children. And in this particular case, it was actually true in a lot of these incidents that there were children that were being physically abused and sexually abused, but there has not been, by and large, evidence that there ever was an underground satanic network or cult that was operating and performing these acts.
Yeah. I mean, certainly there are individuals out there that self-identify as Satanists, but mm-hmm. Satanists of the type that are vilified in Satanic Panic in this movement, they never existed. And that's something that's key to keep in mind. But that's one of the things that's so fascinating about it, is that there is no actual religious group that this is based around. It's all based on hearsay and myth-making and fear.
Yeah, and it's that myth-making largely came out of media sensationalism mm-hmm. in the 80s, too. And in particular, there was one hallmark that we both watched and kind of went back to, which was Geraldo Rivera in 1988 had an expose that was called, where is it, the title of this thing? Devil Worship, Exposing Satan's Underground. And it was this two-hour talk show that he did, interspersed with various, you know, on-the-scene reports of Geraldo talking to victims of satanic ritual abuse. But then in the studio, he was talking to Ozzy Osbourne via satellite, and then he had a Catholic priest on stage, and he had members of the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey's Church of Satan, not mm-hmm. to be confused with the Satanic Panic Satanist cults that were supposedly operating. FBI agents were in the room or on stage who were supposedly, you know, tracking down these underground cults. Rewatching it, I expected to be very skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, I found myself saying, okay, I know about this. I know that this is largely a moral hysteria that happened 30 years ago, but it's compelling. I could see why people fell for it at the time and were, you know, deeply concerned. So yeah, it's just really interesting. But so ultimately, satanic ritual abuse falls under the following claimed practices that were being acted out by these groups, supposedly. There was human sacrifice, sexual depravity, make of that what you will, or perversion. And that these were actual statistics that law enforcement officials were throwing out. 50,000 or more people were dying a year in the United States of America from satanic ritual abuse, supposedly. And during their torture or murders, they were forced to consume urine or feces or blood. And there was just, you know, basically anything that you can think of as being like depraved acts were placed upon at the foot of these mythological groups. I mean, I don't know if mythological is the right term to use here, but they were fantastic.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you start looking back through history at like how we got to this point, because I kind of think of it in terms of a bonfire, right? In which you have all this kindling that's built up, and it's to the point where all you need is that additional spark to really just send it ablaze. The spark being, of course, a threat to the children, or, you know, a threat to, you know, a real personal threat to yourself. Now, if you go back far enough in time, you'll find plenty of accounts of, for instance, blood libel, 1475, the Simon of Trent blood libel, in which an entire Jewish community was tortured over the death of a 2-year-old Christian boy. There were, you know, the claim being that there was a ritual murder of the child.
Yeah.
You can find parallels in witch hunts and witch persecutions throughout time. But, when you're looking particularly at the 20th century, there's a historian by the name of Philip Jenkins who wrote a fabulous piece called Satanism and Ritual Abuse. And this is collected in the Oxford
Handbook of New Religious Movements.
Yes.
I believe it's one of the last chapters in the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting piece. And I think it's one of the best things that I've read that sort of encapsulates the whole hysteria of the time and sort of points to there being similar themes within the satanic panic hysteria to the rhetorical themes that were going on with fringe religions throughout history too. You know, there's an emphasis on protecting endangered children, as we already talked about. But then there's also this idea that religions are shaped by mass media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. This is the only chapter in the book that deals with a non-existent religion. Like the others all deal with actual faiths and splinter groups, but this is one, as we pointed out, never actually exists. Now, you have culturally resonant concepts of the black mass, ritual magic, the witch's Sabbath, all kind of merged together and just a setting back there in the public consciousness. On top of that, you have 1914, you have tales of Aleister Crowley's black masses in exotic London. There were published stories about this in the New York World. So already you have this idea that there are people out there in the world that are engaging in these dark rites. You have 1927 Herbert Gorman's tale, The Place Called Dagon, which is a work of fiction about Satanist or Satanist-like cults that were descended from survivors of Salem.
Yeah, this was a fascinating find for me in the research because I am a fan of weird fiction. I'm a fan of horror fiction. And obviously a lot of that traces back to H.P. Lovecraft's work.
Right.
And H.P. Lovecraft was apparently influenced by this book. And it's something that I had never heard of before. Resonated with me.
Yeah, same here. He apparently mentions it in supernatural horror and literature, which I've read, but he throws out a lot of authors and titles that especially the modern reader is not going to be that connected with. But apparently there's a big influence on Lovecraft, Bloch, Henry Kuttner, Dennis Wheatley, various other individuals who definitely resonated at the time and affected the weird fiction world and then the larger pop culture world to emerge from it.
Yeah, and one of Jenkins' arguments in this piece is that you can trace almost all the elements of the 1980s satanic panic back to this 1927 story, The Place Called Dagon, which ultimately, you know, it's summarized as being like it's a thriller that's set in Western Massachusetts, which is where I'm originally from, and that descendants from Salem, Massachusetts, which if you don't know, Salem is on the east coast of Massachusetts, which is famous for the witch trials and for witchcraft. These descendants moved out to Western Mass and essentially were performing the same satanic rituals and usage of, it actually ties back to what we talked about in a previous podcast about grimoires, the idea of, this sort of, ritual magic being used and these texts being used to perform it.
It's interesting. Jenkins points out that by the 1930s, the roots were already there fictionally, but you also saw a few instances here and there of law enforcement actually beginning to at least entertain the possibility of sacrificial cult activities in some crimes.
Yeah. I think that that's one of the really interesting things that probably helped popularize it too, right? Is that these various law enforcement officials, and I don't think that they necessarily had malicious intent. They probably thought that they had come upon, you know, actual leads in these stories. I mean, you know what I kept thinking of when I was reading this stuff was True Detective, season of True Detective. And I was like, you could look at the first season of True Detective as being about, these misguided, police officers who think that there's a secret, ritualistic cult somewhere that's, you know, running things and abusing children. Which ultimately, you know, that's what that fictional story is about. But ultimately, that was the same narrative that these FBI agents or police officers or whomever were, you know, kind of on the hunt.
Yeah,
because thought was going on. They wanted to be doing their jobs, basically.
Yeah, because I mean, on one hand, you have this fictional world, but then you have these fictional accounts of satanic rites. But then you also have, you know, in the back of everyone's mind, this idea that black mass and ritual mass, magic and the witch's Sabbath was real. You have these stories, that you're reading about in which there are people that are self-identifying as Satanists. For instance, 1966, that's, when Anton LaVey founded the Church of Satan. And obviously that makes the media rounds. People are outraged about that, even though at heart, LaVey's Satanism was really more grounded in, to a certain extent, satire and also cultural commentary, and as well as sort of carny hijinks and fun.
Yeah, I think like this is one of the really important distinctions that we should make here in the podcast, so that there isn't confusion for the listeners. Is that the Anton LaVey Church of Satan is an entirely different philosophy organization. They refer to themselves as a religion, than what was even being imagined as these underground satanic cults. And to sort of summarize it, I'm not the best at Anton LaVey philosophy, but my takeaway from it is that ultimately it was just about a philosophy of individualism.
Yeah.
And that LaVey's thing was that each individual is their own god. And so they used quote unquote Satan as a metaphorical expression, right? Of having pride in yourself and being enlightened because you were your own God. And it was ultimately, about, and they refer to this in the Geraldo special, rational self-interest. But you're right. It was very theatrical and it had like elements of Dadaism to it, I guess. Mm-hmm. This performance where like LaVey dresses up in these robes and has, you know, his eyebrows waxed so that they look villainous, you know. He was playing up to it and he was using terms like Church of Satan or Book of Satan in order to provoke people. But then they were sort of appropriated again, for this panic about satanic ritual abuse, and we're often conflated. It's really fascinating when you watch that Geraldo special to see members of his church. I think at the time LaVey was dead, but like his daughter and another member of his church who at the time was an army colonel, were on stage and answering Geraldo's questions, basically trying to say, you know, what we're talking about here, that they're completely two separate things. This, you know, Church of Satan is a ironic performance philosophy piece, essentially.
Right.
Whereas, like, the accusations of ritual abuse had nothing to do with them.
Right. It is interesting that they were kind of, to a certain extent, they were riding the wave
of the sort of satanic culture, if you will, but then also end up falling into the trap of satanic panic as well.
Yeah.
Because you had, of course, satanic elements in rock music. You had satanic exploitation cinema that really came into its own, especially in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, you also have some real life stuff that's happening, that either has overt, shades of satanic culture to it or, some more subliminal content or even just media shades cast on it, such as Charles Manson, right?
Right, yeah. So Charles Manson obviously, you know, associated himself with, quote, the devil or Satan, even in a looser fashion, I would say, than Anton LaVey did. And again, I suspect for Charles Manson, it was largely theatrical purposes. I believe that he had a quote where he said, "Satan and Christ will come together at the end of the world to judge humanity." And he is actually in that Geraldo special. I think Geraldo had done like a previous special a year earlier on murder where he'd gone and visited Charles Manson and interviewed him. And he's like, you can't even like, gather any kind of coherence from their conversation because Manson's just rambling the whole time. But Geraldo is able to kind of take that and manipulate it through edits and footage to seem like he's at the heart of the satanic ritual abuse.
And then around 1977, you see child abuse really becoming a trending topic in the media, with years of media exposés to follow on child murder, child pornography, kidnapping, very much the stranger danger elements of moral panic that really, I mean, existed before the satanic panic and survived, after it continues to survive in many, many ways.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's understandable now to look back on it and to see why parents are probably terrified at the time. You see real life things like the Jonestown incident happen where there's a massacre that included many children, that were killed by occultist activity.
And so that really takes on a prominent role in the media coverage of threats to children, and in this case, religiously themed threats to children. Then, of course, you have other murderers who end up taking elements from this moral outrage and incorporating it into their crimes, or at least their the way they end up talking about their crimes after the fact. Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker murderer between 1984 and 85.
Yeah.
He was certainly more overt in it than Charles Manson. He would mention Satan during his crimes. His first court appearance, he shows up with a pentagram drawn on his hand, and he yells, "Hail Satan!" And of course, that just throws more kindling on the fire. This idea that there's a danger here with satanic individuals, and they want to hurt us. And then there's a danger present in culture for our children.
Yeah, sort of that behind the scenes that there's a Richard Ramirez or a Charles Manson, they could be anywhere, basically. It's sort of an invasion of the body snatchers all over again, you know. It's this idea that anybody could be part of these networks, anybody could lure your children into danger, or you. And that you should be on heightened alert at all times.
Yeah.
This explains a lot about me as an adult now. Having grown up in that period, I'm like, oh yeah, now I understand why that was so hammered into my head, you know, don't accept candy from strangers, that one, or like the old, is this an old wives' tale or not? I don't know, about Girl Scout cookies with needles in them. Do you remember that one?
I never heard that one. Of course, I always heard the trick-or-treating story, you know, that, oh, you need to be careful because there might be razor blades in the apples.
Yeah,
you know?
We used to have to, after we would trick-or-treat, bring all the candy home, and if it was big enough to have a razor blade in it, my parents would, you know, break it down into smaller pieces to make sure it was safe to eat.
You gotta be careful. I mean, there was, when I was growing up, there was one house in the neighborhood where the guy would put, razor blades in the candied apples every year.
Really?
But they were really good candied apples. So
Yeah. Nobody
said anything.
And
we just kind of
ignore it. Because
if you know it's in there, you just know to take it out and enjoy the treat.
Yeah, it's part of the experience.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend? Or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And now another experience, another activity that's often thrown into the satanic panic culture, of course, is Dungeons and Dragons.
Mm-hmm.
I specifically remember getting into Dungeons and Dragons, and this was in the 90s, so this was after the Satanic Panic had died away for the most part. But I still received, I think, a chick pamphlet.
Jack Chick Track?
Yeah, I received it as part of a birthday present from an aunt one year.
Oh,
it was
anti-Dungeons
and Dragons.
Because, really? Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. So for listeners who don't know, a Chick Track is a very small comic book that is usually like a fundamentally Christian in nature, warning about the perils of pop culture and how they can draw you into not, I don't know necessarily satanic practices, but just, you know, not being a good person and sending you to hell.
Basically, damnation was always the threat.
Yeah.
And it would often include a little, exploitive or grisly kind of imagery to really grab particularly young readers' attention.
Yeah, they're fascinating because they incorporate elements of like the early 1950s horror comics into these comics that are ultimately against that kind of pop culture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love those things. You can actually go online and look at like the whole library of them now.
Oh, wow.
They're fascinating. Yeah, the D&D thing for me, it must have been the late 80s, early 90s when I probably started playing Dungeons & Dragons as a little kid. And shortly thereafter, I had that experience where I went to the a religious school that I mentioned at the top and was sort of terrified that this box set of dice and a monster manual and silly stuff about elves and dwarves and gnomes was somehow going to lead to my demise at satanic ritual abuse.
Well, they did have some pretty heavy demons in there, in addition to the orcs and elves. And then dice, you know, there's something kind of arcane and cryptic about them.
Yeah, and of course, you know, like, we mentioned this before when we talked about grimoires in the other episode, but there's a lot of connections between the system of Dungeons & Dragons' world of magic and the grimoire occult world of magic, you know, they're connected. And obviously people who weren't familiar with either of those things kind of saw them as being one and the same and subsequently associated them with satanic ritual abuse. But it's really interesting. The D&D thing, there was a group that was formed in the 1980s called Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons.
Bothered?
Yeah, and the acronym was BAD.
It was serving the acronym then.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, absolutely. And I believe that they filed a lawsuit against whomever owned D&D at the time. I don't know if that was Gary Gygax or they had gone to TSR at that time or not. But this group then joined forces with this guy who's a psychiatrist named Thomas Radecki. Because they wanted to raise the social awareness of the dangers of Dungeons and Dragons. And they basically associated it with the idea of that in psychotherapy that you act out role-playing as a way to sort of, you know, recover. But that within the game, they were using role-playing for violence and sex and fantasy, and that it would ultimately have the opposite effect. It would lead them down the wrong path. And it was linked with heavy metal music, which we've talked about earlier, and the demons within the thing. But this is what's fascinating to me, is it all comes around again after this whole satanic panic movement kind of fades away in the mid-90s. And you start finding out that a lot of this, you know, their accusations weren't true. And then academics started doing real research on Dungeons and Dragons, and they found that for instance, one of the accusations that BAD made about Dungeons and Dragons was that it increased the chance of your kid committing suicide. Mm-hmm. In fact, I believe the founder was the mother of a teenager who committed suicide, and she blamed it on Dungeons and Dragons. But there was empirical research that proved that in fact was not the case, and that rates of suicide were lower in kids who played Dungeons and Dragons. And there was also no measurable negative impact on their psychological functioning, emotional measures, or reality testing. This is all from an article in Psychology Today that was published in 2014 about Dungeons and Dragons, Satan, and psychology. Their final conclusions here are basically that the leaders of this group, BAD, had completely exaggerated their own credentials. They cherry-picked their data for convenience, obviously, of, making Dungeons and Dragons look bad. And then this is the real interesting fact. So the psychiatrist that they associated with, Radecki, he in particular was arrested in 2013 for sexually exploiting his patients. He was trading medicine for sexual favors from his patients.
Oh.
So this same guy who is accusing Dungeons and Dragons of being responsible for sexual abuse himself was a perpetrator.
Oh. All right. So far we've discussed the cultural kindling for the most part that leads up to the moral panic of satanic panic. As historian Philip Jenkins points out in his piece Satanism and Ritual Abuse, you can really trace a lot of the SRA satanic ritual abuse outcry to this particular book that comes out in 1980 titled Michelle Remembers. It comes out and it really cements this notion of ritualized sexual abuse by satanic cults, everything we've been talking about, black robes, you know, vile rites, the abuse against children, and it entails the so-called Michelle's memories that are recalled during therapy in the 1970s of her sexual abuse in the 1950s in Vancouver. So we're talking Ozzy and Harriet era here.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about Michelle Remembers, which, again, this was a book that I was not familiar with before we dove into the research for this, is that Michelle Smith, who was the patient that underwent the therapy and was the subject of this book, her therapist later became her husband. Mm-hmm. So this man who helped her uncover these memories, they also began an intimate relationship together. But over the course of the years, many people have discredited the claims that were made within the book, both psychologists and, I believe, people from her actual past.
Yeah, I think literally all of the charges that that come out of her personal accounts of this abuse comes from West African secret societies, accounts of them anyway, that were imported into Canada in the 1950s. But this narrative becomes really popular, and it has two key things it does here. It leads to other survivor accounts that spring up, other people that are writing books about their reclaimed memories of satanic abuse in the past, and it also really pushes and to a certain extent legitimizes the theory that traumatic memories can remain dormant only to be recalled later by a therapist.
Yeah, it's really the common theme that runs throughout most of the satanic panic hysteria is this scientific idea of repressed memories being a psychological phenomenon, that certain therapists are going to be able to dig deep enough and pull out this traumatic memory and make you, you know, realize what truly made you the way that you are, what is actually causing your problems. And it was everybody from psychotherapists to child welfare advocates. And they didn't, you know, again, like the law enforcement officials that were involved, I don't think that they necessarily had malicious intentions. Maybe some of them saw some profit. I would imagine that the author of Michelle Remembers saw some good paychecks out of that book's popularity. Mm-hmm. But, you know, basically, they thought that this was evidence of these satanic cults actually existing, and they wanted to protect small children. That was essentially what they saw from it. And so they used hypnosis or different kinds of psychological protocols to essentially, you know, save people from Satan, to save people from these past traumatic events, and to dig up dirt on the actual, you know, threat that was still out there, which led to a lot of finger pointing and in some cases, which we'll talk about later with like West Memphis 3, accusations that sent people to jail unjustly.
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly see the attractiveness of it, both on the treatment side and the patient side. I mean, if you're feeling like you're out of sorts in the world, like you have some problem, and if only you could just tear out the root cause of it, right? And then if there is this, this narrative that's presented to you that, well, perhaps in the past you were abused, perhaps you were abused by this nefarious organization, and all the main thing we need to do, or at least the first step, is to get those memories out of the dark, out of the, you know, the closet of your mind, and pull them out to where we can dispel them.
And to give you an idea of just how prevalent this was, an organization formed in 1993 around this idea of repressed memories. It was called the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. And here's some statistics I found from a USA Today article at the time when it was first formed and they were interviewing them. They said that they had done a survey where they interviewed 3,000 families. And their preliminary findings were that of just these 3,000 people, 20% of the children within these families said that they, people who are adults now but who had been children, say that they had been tortured in satanic rituals. So 20% of the 3,000 people that they interviewed, that's huge to me and sounds like an astronomical number when you apply that kind of generalization to the entire American population. And then there's this also interesting study, a group of psychologists at the State University of New York at Buffalo looked further into it, and they found that of 800 therapists had at least – or sorry, they interviewed 30,000 therapists, and 800 of them said that they had at least once in their sessions with their patients had come across cases of satanic ritual abuse. So this – I mean, there was hard evidence as far as people – saw it, that mm-hmm. this was happening, that it was pervasive, and it needed to be stopped.
Yeah. And of course, these narratives that they're pulling out, they're obviously informed by the established narrative in the culture, that mm-hmm. that of the retrieved memories, but also all of these influences we've talked about before, the culture of black masses and Sabbaths, every devil movie that came out in the 1960s, 70s, yeah. and 80s, all of it coloring your perceptions. Of the adults, anyway. Now, what happens when you attempt to pull these types of memories from a small child, though, from someone who hasn't seen Rosemary's Baby, who hasn't heard Geraldo on television talking about the dangers of death metal, etc.
Yeah.
Well, we see that in a very pivotal 1984 case, the McMartin Preschool sexual abuse case in Southern California. And this is a case where prosecutors charged that a ring of teachers were sexually abusing hundreds of small children in rituals that involved robes and masks and pentacles and church altars. And the case now is regarded as completely bogus.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, it sent out these waves of fear just throughout the society. It got picked up on the media and just, boosted, tenfold. In this case, like cases to follow, it followed a particular flow. You had a limited, plausible accusation of abuse that emerges at a school.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have an investigation and interrogate the child, and then you get this therapist-derived account from an impressionable young child regarding what happened. And since these kids, for the most part, they have no knowledge of adult sexuality, but they can tell that this concerned adult authority figure is trying to get something disturbing out of them. So what does a small child bring to the table? What can they possibly pull out? They start talking about, oh, well, they made me drink pee-pee. They made me eat poop.
Yeah. Yeah. It's basically like they go for their version of whatever the worst taboo possible thing could be at the time. And, so of course they think of it as being things like that. It's the word coprophilia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that McMartin incident was one of many.
Yeah.
I believe in the Geraldo special as well, they talked about a Presidio daycare center that had a very similar kind of incident that was labeled as being potentially attached to satanic ritual abuse. And there is an interesting part too where they talked about the McMartin school abuse scandal, I believe, and they started comparing their idea of satanic rituals as being somehow associated with the Episcopal Church, which I thought was interesting. It felt like this strange smear campaign against Episcopals, as if it wasn't like a valid form of Christianity. It was brief, but it was kind of interesting.
And so in both of these cases, we see this established in the media, in the increasingly in the public mindset, that satanic ritual abuse is a threat to our children, as well as to the child that we used to be, that we all could have been conceivably sexually abused by Satanists in the past, mm-hmm. and we have only to pull that out of our out of the closet of our memory. But the thing is, it goes beyond just Geraldo Rivera, right? It becomes a part of it becomes disseminated outward through professional organizations, through police, therapists, youth workers, seminars aimed at the discovery of new satanic abuse histories. And so you reach the point by the 1980s where the panic is spreading outward into the UK, into Australia, Canada, the Netherlands, South Africa, anywhere that American therapeutic and criminological literature is read.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the Netherlands part is one of the ones that's interesting to me. So I am a fan of heavy metal music,
okay.
And the Netherlands and Norway in particular are known for as being the home of black metal, this particular genre of metal, which was largely associated with this sort of traditionalist movement of burning down Christian churches. And some of their members were accused and tried for murder. And so even though they didn't necessarily have, I don't even think like possibly their song lyrics have anything to do with Satan or devil worship, but because they were against Christianity, again, the satanic panic's hysteria sort of spread over there.
Yeah. So the cultural kindling was perfect for that spark to fly across the ocean and take root.
Yeah, absolutely.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe.
Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
It's interesting, too, like how much of the messaging was, of course, aimed at parents, but also at teenagers, about the dangers of all the stuff about Dungeons and Dragons and the music. And, you know, when you're a teenager, of course, all you want to do is find the significance in your life and at times lash out against the authority figures and their right. expectations. So you actually end up fleeing to that stuff. Like I definitely had a copy of both that fake Necronomicon and the Satanic Bible, with nice paperback versions of both.
Yeah. The Satanic Bible was a bestseller.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were a lot of, both adolescents and adults with that same experience. Mm-hmm. They were like, oh, I'll buy this. You know, it was kind of I imagine it's the kind of thing that you would find at Urban Outfitters nowadays or something near the checkout line.
Yeah. But I remember having both those books, listening to Marilyn Manson.
Yeah.
You know, very much, engaging in that, you know, on one level in the possibility that there was something to all this darkness, but also just in the, you know, need to stand apart from the adult world.
Yeah, it's the traditional sort of adolescent anti-authoritarian reflex, right? Combined with the hysteria at the time moving around satanic ritual abuse.
Yeah.
So I could see why the two would be conflated.
I mean, especially if you grow up in like a Christian, or even just vaguely Christian environment in which you have the dichotomy of good and evil, of God and Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you're going to have a tendency to sympathize with the villain in that piece, and then buy his book.
Yeah, it is right, exactly. And so like my experience growing up was literally being in one of these, private Christian schools where I was told constantly, if you do the wrong thing, then you're going to be possessed by a demon and you'll possibly murder your family. I mean, this was like an actual thing that our pastor would tell us in class every day.
Wow.
And so, you know, I mean, this was probably around, I don't know, 90, 91. So, mm-hmm. So towards the tail end of this stuff, but you know, they fill your head with this enough. It's as bad, if not worse, than Ozzy Osbourne lyrics or King Diamond, you know?
Yeah, because, you know, that stuff is just largely engaging in fun and theme.
It's theatrical. Yeah. I don't know. As a person who's into heavy metal, I don't know of a lot of people who are famous metal musicians that are serious members of a satanic organization.
Yeah. I mean, I think of like some of the interviews I've seen with, like Meshuggah is a metal act that I enjoy. And, if you just listen to their lyrics and their music, you get very much the theme they're going for, and this, the dark, the heavy, the, you know, industrial disturbing nature of the thing. But then you see an interview with them and they just seem like goofy guys
for
their music, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was probably the case with Ozzy Osbourne as well. He's in that Geraldo thing and it's hilarious watching him be interviewed. He's much more lucid than, the later Ozzy Osbourne of reality TV.
Oh,
that
yeah,
we encountered
the one
that early 2000s.
Yeah,
but he, you know, he obviously wasn't articulate enough to kind of argue on his own behalf of why he was just using these elements, this imagery and symbology, mm-hmm. Theatrically as part of his stage persona, rather than, you know, it being directly impactful on, teenagers in America committing crimes against other children or their peers even. There were moments in the Geraldo special where they're interviewing kids who are in prison for having killed their peers in school. Like I can't remember the name of the particular guy. He'd probably be a little older than us now, probably in his 40s. But there was an interview with him, and he just, you know, straight up blames it on heavy metal and satanic participation.
I have a feeling it was Sean Sellers or Pete Rowland.
Pete Rowland. That was it. That was the guy. Yeah. Yeah. So it's, you know, I think it was also easy for people like that who had committed these atrocious crimes to say, to put the locus of control externally onto something else and to say, it wasn't me. It's not inside of me. I didn't mean to do this. It was because of heavy metal or Dungeons and Dragons or.
Yeah. And they're just, yeah, they're just taking the excuse that the media has crafted for them and presented them and say, hey, it's not your fault. It's because you got involved in this thing that has a viral component that if you just start rolling the Dungeons and Dragons dice, if you start listening to this heavy metal music, that it's just a slippery slope to just violent outbreaks and demonic possession.
Yeah. And that leads us to the West Memphis Three.
Yeah.
You want to talk about them now?
Oh, yeah. Because I think that's certainly a case, even though it kind of, it tends to fall towards the end of the life cycle of Satanic Panic.
Yeah.
It represents some of the worst residual effects of Satanic Panic, at least on, an individual level.
Mm-hmm. So this happened, in between 1993 and 1995, I believe, whereas mm-hmm. the actual murders happened in 93, I think.
Yes.
And, the trial lasted, or there are multiple trials, I believe, for 2 years. But essentially, if you want to know more about this, I highly suggest that you go watch these documentaries that they're called Paradise Lost. Is that
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm. HBO, I believe.
Yeah. And they're really well put together by a crew that was basically there shooting from, the minute these guys were on trial. And it sort of documents the cases throughout the 20 years. I haven't seen the last one.
I don't think I've seen it either.
I don't know if it goes up to the 2011 when
right.
these guys were released. But essentially, to boil it down to its simplest terms, these three teenagers in West Memphis, Arkansas, were accused of, tried, and convicted for murdering three younger boys. And it was supposedly part of a satanic ritual. These three guys were all fans of heavy metal. They looked the part, and it was easy to place the blame on them. However, in 2011, they were able to make a plea for their innocence based on DNA that was recovered from the scene, and they were released. Essentially, the judge said, you're guilty up to time served.
Yeah.
So the time that they had served from 1993 until 2011, And they're out now. You've probably seen there's fictional feature accounts of this story. What's the movie? The Devil's Knot.
Devil's Knot, I believe. It's
It has a Reese Witherspoon in it as one of the mothers of the victims. Colin Firth, I believe, plays a private investigator who's working on their behalf to try to find evidence that proves their innocence.
It's a complex case, and it's one that's
extremely complicated. Yeah, that's why I don't feel like we can really do it justice here without doing an entire episode
right,
on it.
Because you have bungled investigations on one hand. You definitely have Satanic Panic in play.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of stuff, too, weird stuff that goes on mm-hmm. between some of the parents and the people making the documentary, where the filmmakers themselves sort of become part of the story, and there's implications that maybe one or two of the parents might have been involved in the actual murders themselves. It's really confusing and disturbing, but ultimately it comes down to that the three teenagers who were convicted of these crimes were in fact innocent, and wrongfully put away for crimes they didn't commit.
Yeah, of course, sadly, crimes that we don't have an answer for. We don't know who was responsible
for
them.
Yeah, exactly. That's the sad part is that the person or persons who did do it got away with it.
Yeah. But luckily, as we said, this occurred towards the end of Satanic Panic. As it's going out, as it's leaving the public mindset and becoming far less of a media obsession. And you might wonder, well, what caused that? What makes us get away from that? What creates a situation so that by 1995 you see cases where the media doesn't jump on the satanic bandwagon for abuse charges at an elementary? How do we get to the point where by 1999 you have the Columbine shootings? And despite all the various theories that come up initially in the wake of that awful incident, Satanism is not one of them.
Right. Yeah, that could have very easily have been tagged within the Satanic Panic.
Easily. And if it had occurred years earlier, no doubt it would have.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this really interesting article that I read called The Satanic Ritual Abuse Panic as a Religious Studies Data as part of the journal International Review for the History of Religions. This was written in 2003 that summarizes sort of the entire era of Satanic Panic and looks at this sort of ending phase. And their conclusion is there is no evidence for abusive Satanic cults existing. Anything that connected them as ever existing largely came from these repressed memories. Mm-hmm. Or they were extracted from small children who then subsequently recovered from what happened to them through the use of psychotherapy. But there was no actual tenable forensic evidence that these groups ever existed or responsible for these crimes. There's sort of a sadder thing at play here, I think, which is that human culture maybe has a harder time dealing with child abuse or violence, especially this kind of, you know, horrific violence, as in the case of the West Memphis mm-hmm. Three, especially sexual abuse, without being able to place it into a fantastic narrative that is somehow outside of the everyday. And that's the unfortunate part about this, is that in a lot of these cases where these children and people were abused, were hurt, oftentimes it was just their friends or relatives. You know,
That is the most disturbing thing of all, because you want to be able to position that kind of thing outside of your immediate sphere. Mm-hmm. You want to place it on an other.
Exactly.
And even if they look like you and seem to be the same group, like if the narrative is, oh, well, they're secretly a Satanist, that's far easier to wrap your head around, as fantastic as some of the ramifications are, than to say, well, they're just this person that we just thought were like us, someone that lived within our sphere, within our family even.
Yeah, this is a good quote that I liked from that article that addresses that. The author, whose last name is Frankfurter, I don't know what his first name is, he says, "Human memory, psychologists have shown, is clearly not a matter of historical snapshots, even in the cases of trauma, and it is enormously subject to suggestion, fantasy, social conditions, and cultural nuances." So largely, I think that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you basically had a situation where the experts moved in, the actual experts, not the ones that would appear on like the Serrato special, and they said, look, it doesn't exist. You had people like Kenneth Lanning, FBI lead investigator on these so-called sex rings, who was skeptical of it from the beginning and then was an outspoken critic of it in the media. You had a 1994 study of ritual crime allegations sponsored by the National Center on Child Abuse and Neglect, and it discredited virtually everything. It was a massive study, and they only found a very few cases of lone or paired perpetrators using ritualized tactics to intimidate children or thrill themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at 12,000 incidents, and they couldn't find a single one that provided evidence, quote, of a well-organized intergenerational satanic cult who sexually molested and tortured children in their homes or schools for years and committed a series of murders, unquote. So UK studies end up backing this up. The McMartin preschool case falls apart.
Right.
So the media begins to realize, oh, well, there isn't anything to this story. This is they start talking to the actual experts, and the discrediting of Satanic Panic becomes the media narrative for a while, effectively killing it off, at least in the United States. But then, of course, you have lingering elements of it that remain in other areas, particularly in South Africa, for years to follow.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I think is an interesting question for us to sort of pose to ourselves and to the audience mm-hmm. is we have had these moments of hysteria throughout human history, you know, Satanic Panic. One of the ones that comes to mind for me is something that I researched here for a video that we did about the Pokemon Panic in Japan in the late 90s. There was this idea that there was an incident where an episode of Pokemon supposedly caused seizures in kids.
Oh, I do
and then,
remember
like,
this. Yeah.
I believe it was something like, I can't remember the exact statistics off the top of my head, but something like 3,000 kids overnight claimed that they all had seizures.
Mm-hmm.
So these kinds of, you know, like we were talking about earlier about how our memory and trauma is susceptible to suggestion and cultural nuances. They recur over and over again in human history, but I can't really remember a large incident of that in the last, I don't know, decade, other than Ebola
and and vaccines.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Or at least vaccines surrounding the anti-vaccine movement. Well, I guess on both sides, depending.
Yeah. 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 So it's kind of fascinating. They have, and neither of those, I think, really got the traction that stuff like Satanic Panic did.
Right.
And I don't know why that is. It's interesting to think about, though, you know, is it because of the proliferation of social media? It spreads information faster and farther. Or is it simply because, you know, mass media has been around long enough now that there's somewhat of an inoculation maybe against the hysteria that can be spread by it? I'm not sure.
Well, there's certainly more voices in the media.
Yeah.
I mean, there are more channels. There are more people on the channels talking constantly about the subject matter. So,
yeah.
Maybe our media is less susceptible to long-term panic with no grounded evidence to support.
Yeah. It does make you wonder, like, could something like witch trials or satanic panic happen today? You know, are we as humans susceptible to that still?
I have a feeling we are. I think a lot of it comes down to the particular environment that we find ourselves in.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we are a little less susceptible to it just based on how much information is out there. It just comes down to how much information are we willing to ignore to support this script.
Yeah.
For what has happened or what could happen to us that fulfills some need to either make the danger more tolerable, you know, more palpable. Like we were saying, sometimes the more outrageous explanation for something is more attractive because it's easier to handle because it's you position it outside of your own sphere.
And it has lines and boundaries that you can sort of use to stick to the narrative, stick to the script, and try to understand experiences that are so horrifying that normally otherwise you wouldn't be able to understand them.
All right, so there you have it, Satanic Panic. We took you through it from the beginning to the end of it, and we would love to hear from any of you out there who, like us, have some element of their childhood immersed in the world of Satanic Panic, or if you came about after Satanic Panic, we'd love to hear an outsider's take on all of this. Like, do you see any of these elements at work in your modern world? If you would like to learn more, check out the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. I'll include links out to some of the resources that we mentioned. And what about you, sir?
You can find me personally at christiansager.tumblr.com. For the How Stuff Works content that I produce, I am primarily working on the Brain Stuff YouTube channel. If you haven't seen that yet, check it out. That's our general science channel. And I also work on the main How Stuff Works YouTube channel as well, where we're producing shows like What the Stuff, and interviews and content like that.
Cool, cool. Thanks once again to Christian for joining me here. And in the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me, you can reach out to stufftoblowyourmind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road.
With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.